You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, July 8th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, me and new NSA revelations. Meanwhile, what's the matter with Kansas? Here's a hint. No taxes. Also, it may be 7-8, but it's more like 420 in Washington State. I'm sorry. And Tucker Carlson, is he a Cuban spy? And while Moral Mondays continue in North Carolina, and a big voter ID case with a novel legal theory. What else do we have? Oh, and of course, we're looking at another Israeli military incursion into the Gaza Strip that seems to be in the offing. All that and more on today's program. Just me today, folks.
Just you.
Just me.
Just you entirely.
Our mics have been cut. It's just Sam today.
That's right. I want to start off. We're going to obviously have... We're going to be talking more about what's going on in Israel and Palestine. I know Michael interviewed Reza Aslan yesterday as both to inform you all about what's going on there and to meet his obligations for his other jobs.
Incidentally, Reza Aslan also – no, I'm just kidding. I was going to plug a product.
Right.
But I couldn't think of a new product to plug, so the joke stalled.
Matt will be interviewing himself for his Tumblr later in the week.
That is most of his segments.
I want to read, you know, like I say, later in the week, we're hoping to have a guest who can talk about this in more depth. But I want to read part of a Facebook post that was posted by Yuval Diskin. He is the former head of Shin Bet, which is Israel's, I don't want to say FBI because it has actually, I think, a broader a mandate, but it's almost Israel's FBI, CIA, but internal. Yes, maybe closer to MI5. And he was the head of Shin Bet from 2005 to 2011. There is some talk that he may run for office, but I don't think this in any way diminishes what he is obviously willing to say publicly. I'm going to read part of it. It starts, "Dear friends, don't be confused for a moment. This is the result of the policy conducted by the current government, whose essence is, let's frighten the public over everything that's happening around us in the Middle East. Let's prove that there's no Palestinian partner. Let's build more and more settlements and create a reality that cannot be changed. Let's continue not dealing with the severe problems of the Arab sector in Israel. Let's continue not solving the severe social gaps in Israeli society. This illusion worked wonderfully as long as the security establishment was able to provide impressive calm on the security front over the last few years as a result of the high-quality, dedicated work of the people of the Shin Bet, the IDF, and the Israel police, as well as the Palestinians, whose significant contribution to the relative calm in the West Bank should not be taken lightly. However, the rapid deterioration we're experiencing in the security situation did not come because of the vile murder of Naftali, Eyal, and Gilad. May their memories be blessed. The deterioration is first and foremost the result of the illusion that the government's inaction on every front can actually freeze the situation in place. The illusion that price tag is simply a few slogans on the wall and not pure racism. The illusion that everything can be solved with a little more force. The illusion that the Palestinians will accept everything that's done in the West Bank and won't respond despite the rage and frustration and the worsening economic situation. The illusion that the international community won't impose sanctions on us. That the Arab citizens of Israel won't take to the streets at the end of the day because of the lack of care for their problems. And that the Israeli public will continue submissively to accept the government's helplessness in dealing with the social gaps that its policies have created and are worsening, while corruption continues to poison everything good, and so on and so on. You know, I hope that the images of this 15-year-old boy from Florida who is of Palestinian descent getting beaten to a pulp by Israeli police force forces will, you know, change some of the public opinion, particularly in the Jewish community in this country. For a long time, I've felt that Israel is on a path to destroy itself. I think this captures, this Disc and Post captures the illusion that at least a large percentage of Israelis seem to be operating under, which is that this status quo of continued repression of Palestinians is sustainable. It's not. And at one point, something's going to give. And if those people who support the existence of Israel want the country to remain intact, it's time for the supporters of Israel even to wake up to the reality of the situation on the ground and realize that it is an unjust system that is simply not sustainable.
But don't you think the other really key factor is to let go of any type of delusion that there's any type of symmetry of power in this situation? Because I feel like the narrative that even says, you know, a pox on both houses, this is a cycle of violence, and of course, condemn Hamas, condemn these horrific killings that, you know, there's no evidence Hamas did, but I'm just saying generally condemn terrorism.
Yeah, and it's sort of atypical.
But the reality,
right.
Oh, they didn't do it.
Right. I think it's atypical of Hamas to not take credit for something like that.
They didn't even take credit. They said, we didn't do it, but it was a great thing to do. They're protecting their brand. It's disgusting, but that's what it is. But fundamentally, like, Israel is the power here. There's no dispute about it. They have the most powerful military in the region. They run an occupied people's lives. And, you know, that's just the kind of fundamental, unavoidable fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's indisputable. I mean, that's also the argument that Diskin's making. This notion that you can drum up this fear that there is an existential threat to this country is long gone. That may have been the case 50, 40 years ago, 30 years ago. But it is not the case today. And I would also say that to the extent that there is that not only is there a problem with people deluding themselves as to the parity of strength of the Israelis and the Palestinians, there is also a too much, I think, trying to win some type of moral argument about the founding of Israel or the moral argument as to who was there first. I mean, if anything, there is a denial of the existence of the Palestinian people. Not if anything. I mean, there is a denial of the existence of the Palestinian people having lived in what is now Israel prior to 1948. There, you know, it is well established that there was a society there, a culture there, but nevertheless, for those people who cannot get past, and I think it's, you know, on the Israeli supporter side, the idea of talking about Yasser Arafat at this point. I mean, I've had these conversations with people, and I consider myself, at least in the sense that I think Israel should exist, as a supporter of Israel in that regard. But for those people who consider themselves Zionists or supporters of Israel's right to exist, you've got to wake up to the reality that if you really do want Israel to be around in 50 years, you better acknowledge what's going on the ground and realize that this is unsustainable and that the future is not on your side.
And I think the other thing, regardless of, I know Reza yesterday made a very strong case that just logistically, geographically, two states is done. And a lot of people think that. A lot of people think a two-state solution is just literally a physical impossibility at this point.
Because of the nature of
settlements, because of the nature of how just, yeah, maybe primarily settlements at this point. But I think that even if you still are someone who wants some type of genuine two-state solution, you also have to realize that this current iteration of the peace process is totally fraudulent. And has been used to obscure the fact that, right, like settlements have never stopped being built.
Right.
There hasn't been. And, you know, and even that offer that Barak gave Arafat, the way Arafat responded to it wasn't helpful, obviously. But any genuine leader looking to establish a state would have to say, well, wait a second, there isn't continuous roads here. And what about water access?
Right. I mean, I think those are real questions.
Well, those are fundamental
things. We're going to give you a bunch of arid land, exactly, that you will not have access to water. I mean, it was about control and the, you know.
It's about control.
And so you can say 99% or 97.3% of whatever you ask for, that's fine. But, you know, if I give you I gave you 97% of the house. I just didn't give you the part where there was a bathroom or a kitchen. All right. You know, that's basically what the deal was.
And I've been living in the house for a while.
Right.
Right. So I think – but I think that getting real about both of those things, what the actual situation is, and then that – but even then pivoting and saying like, okay, we need to get serious again about the peace process. Well, the peace process hasn't been serious for at least over a decade.
Right.
And that's being very sympathetic.
I mean, I still think that the because the Bush administration did not function – in the way that Israeli politics needed it to, which was to basically be an external check on the worst impulses of the Israeli government and the Israeli people, which it had traditionally been. And it provided for Israel a short circuit we can't go further into this this war because of, or we cannot go further. We need to pull back because America is basically telling us to. Because the Bush administration basically encouraged more aggression from the Israelis, I think it fundamentally broke the entire dynamic. And, you know, I've talked in the past sort of metaphorically where the Republican Party allowed its Frankenstein and grew it so much that it lost control of it. In some respects, because the Israeli government relied on the United States to be a check on its worst impulses, and it wasn't there for 8 years. In fact, it was the opposite. Frankenstein is now basically running the streets. And I think it's actually gone too far. I mean, that's the argument about the lack of a two-state solution. It's just simply the ability for the Israelis to create facts on the ground. What they didn't realize they were doing is they were boxing themselves in.
Right. Well, and those are the two. There's the idealistic argument of wanting to have a binational, non-ethnic democracy. That's one thing. And then, yeah, then there's just the, okay, you've created so many facts on the ground, as you say, that literally the only debate becomes, will everybody living inside this polity have basic democratic human rights?
Right. I mean, I think the only way you do a two-state solution at this point is you say to the settlers, you're now Palestinian citizens. I mean, honestly, you give them the choice.
Totally. Absolutely.
We're going to provide, here's, I don't know, $500 billion worth of aid to help you become naturalized Palestinian citizens if you want. There's also a bus heading back to Haifa.
You got a week.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. We're not going to even send the military in to pull you out. It's up to you.
Absolutely, no, because the military is gone because we're actually doing this.
Right. I mean, that seems to me to be the only way to do it, but if you're going to have a two-state solution, that's unlikely. But it's also hard to imagine Israeli politics being able to become sort of a more multi-religious country. I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, but all right, let's move on. There was a big story in the Washington Post yesterday. For, as you know, for over, I guess, over a year since the first revelations of Edward Snowden's whistleblowing, NSA officials have insisted that Edward Snowden only had access to reports about what the NSA was doing and what information they could glean, or basically their intercepts. They argued that he did not actually have access to the intercepts. So all his talk of, I can see the emails of, if I wanted to, I could see the emails of the president, or I could see emails of average United States citizens, was bunk, according to the NSA. This guy's just a narcissist. He's just self-aggrandizing. Well, this is going to come as a shock to everybody. It turns out they were lying.
Surprise, surprise.
Snowden provided the Washington Post with 22,000 intercepts containing, 22,000 intercept reports containing 160,000 individual intercepts. Apparently, the Post has spent months reviewing these files, and they estimate that 11% of the intercepted accounts, and by intercepted accounts, we mean the emails, the actual emails, the text messages, the seductive pictures of guys looking in the mirror and flexing their pecs, and women in negligees. 160,000 individual intercepts. 11% of the intercept accounts belong to NSA targets, and the remaining 89% were incidental. and I'm using the word incidental loosely, it's really hard, I think, to justify the notion that your signal-to-noise ratio is that out of whack. Now, according to the Post, they found revelations about a secret overseas nuclear project, double dealing by an ostensible ally, a military calamity that befell an unfriendly power, and the identities of aggressive intruders into U.S. computer networks. However, the other 89%, which was described as useless by the analysts who were looking over them, were nonetheless retained. Now, it's quite clear. Yeah, I mean, it's useless information. However, these medical records, these resumes, maybe we should just keep them just in case.
Useless does not mean unintriguing.
The Post found that the agency standards for classifying someone as a foreigner could apply to tens of millions of Americans. It includes anyone who logs into an email account while traveling outside of the country or using proxy servers located outside the U.S. At least one subject was classified as foreign because the person communicated in a non-English language. According to the Post, these surveillance files tell stories of love and heartbreak, illicit sexual liaisons, mental health crises, political and religious conversions, financial anxieties, and disappointed hopes. Now, the funniest thing, and
those are
I,
just the tweets from this office. The
no kidding,
office.
Right? Exactly. The funniest thing about this is the arguments that, and somehow, Snowden has infringed upon all our civil liberties by informing the Post and proving to the Post, because that was really the issue, right? Proving to the Post that he had access to these documents. I will go back to what I said in the first weeks after these revelations. It is quite clear and almost obvious at this point that if Snowden had access to these things, other people did. And the idea that there wasn't someone who already had used this material in an illicit way is beyond belief. It took months, and maybe even to this day, because either the NSA was lying about Snowden having access to this material or simply did not realize it. And if they did not realize it, there is no reason to believe that they would realize that someone else who was perhaps selling this material to foreign governments or just like, hey, Jim, my name is Steve. For $500, I will send you what your wife has been corresponding with your dentist. The point being that Snowden essentially has told everyone what he took, or at least has told journalists and the NSA, or to the extent that it's been revealed. It's not clear, and it should be, no one should have confidence that the NSA would be aware that other people hadn't taken similar stuff, but actually for other purposes rather than whistleblowing. And I guess the really embarrassing thing was the presidential's panel That was to look at the NSA. Liz Gottian, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. It appears that in the Snowden documents, the information is collected deliberately in far broader circumstances than what the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board discussed. They didn't even realize what he had access to. And it, despite the fact that they're the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board talked about major reforms, it's becoming clear that they probably weren't even aware of the full extent of the abuses. So I guess it's back to the drawing board for that presidential committee. It's stunning. I don't think it's getting as much attention, at least in the media, but it still seems that, at least in the context of Congress, there still seems to be some impetus for reform, but I don't know how much, frankly.
Not enough.
Not enough is right. Meanwhile, folks, if this is, good news in New York State. On Monday, New York became the 23rd state to legalize certain forms of marijuana for medical purposes. Cuomo the Lesser signed the legislation. Passed both houses of the legislature during the final moments of the legislative session in June. It is significantly more restrictive than other medical marijuana laws across the country. It permits only doctors to prescribe the drug in forms including oil-based and vapor, and only for a short list of conditions such as cancer, AIDS, epilepsy, and multiple sclerosis. It allows the governor, upon recommendation by the state police superintendent or health commissioner, to suspend the program at any time. It bans smokable forms of marijuana. And, however, of course, it is a step forward. Meanwhile, in Washington State today, marijuana is now legal to be sold at, I don't know what you call them, pot stores?
Head shops, right? Or is that just where they sell, like,
head
like
shops.
Bongs?
Yeah. What'd you do? You just come back in a time machine from the 70s?
They're still calling head shops.
They're called head shops, yeah. So look at you, trying to get all slick. You own gold yourself.
There's about 250 establishments licensed by Washington State. They're not all going to be set up, I think, as of today. And it is expected that there's going to be massive shortages of pot. Not surprising. Unlike Colorado, which had a medical marijuana program, when they began to sell pot, legalize pot to be sold recreationally, I think it was at the beginning of the year. I think it was in January. There they just had a highly regulated medical marijuana system and they just basically expanded it. Washington State is going more or less 0 to 50. Long lines and products shortages are expected. Apparently, according to, Opal OG Kush and Copper Kush. Oh, wait. No, those are new pots. New forms of pot, I guess. Lathrop's Cannabis City, I should say, will be selling pot from $15 to $20 a gram, including taxes. Apparently, that's more expensive, I think. Than pot has been going, but I think it's because there's shortages and Also, I guess at Cannabis City, it's all organic. So, CoolJ146 asked me, what's your favorite strain of ganja? And I will plead a certain amount of ignorance to this. I've been watching on occasion Doug Benson's Get High with Doug YouTube because he explains it.
Oh, really?
Yes. But if I recall correctly, it's the marijuana that that gives you a little more of an up feeling than a down feeling. Now, there's two different types. I never got into, and there was a time in my life where I smoked a healthy amount of marijuana. But it was really just like I went from dime bag to, you know, whatever $50 will get me. Like, I didn't know, you know, brands. There was a time in New York where, and I imagine that still exists, but I'm not aware of it, where you could just get a guy to come with you on a bicycle and they'd bring out like a bunch of little plastic vials and have different names. And it never really occurred to me that there was much of a difference. So,
not the most discerning.
No, I'm
weed
far
smoker.
More.
You're a big picture guy.
I'm a big picture weed guy. I'm far more discerning when it comes to apples. I know like all the different types of varieties of apples.
Sam knows his apples. I'll
Sam
tell you that
knows
much.
His healthy munchies.
You got to see him with the apples,
but not the.
No, I held. I held court on apples. I've instituted a, for what it's worth, a Sammy Cam on the 3 to 6 show. And during the break, I can't get an IM in that facility in which I'm located because I can't. Apparently, they won't let Adium operate there, but on their network. But I was taking tweets. And somebody asked me about apples, and I held court on apples. This one story also I want to alert you to. There is another challenge. And I guess in the coming days, I will touch on what's happening with Wheaton College. It didn't make huge news, but it's in a nutshell, I'll explain it right now. In the Hobby Lobby case, and I should also note that it was clarified by the Supreme Court that the Hobby Lobby case was not just limited to the four types of contraception that Hobby Lobby mistakenly thought caused abortions. The Supreme Court clarified the next day that it involved all contraceptive care. Even the ones that the stupid Hobby Lobby people knew didn't cause abortion. It applies to all contraceptive care that exists, essentially, and is offered by insurers without a copay. In that Hobby Lobby case, the argument by the five male Catholic conservative justices who ruled in favor of this corporation and its religious soul, they said that the government has an easy remedy for Hobby Lobby's refusal to, I guess, engage with health insurance that provides this, because they had an option, and that option, of course, was to simply not get the tax benefit for offering their employees health insurance. That easy remedy by the government was a system set up by the HHS for exemption for religious organizations like Catholic hospitals, which are arguably more of a religious nature. Well, the day after Hobby Lobby was issued, maybe it was 2 days, Maybe it was 5 days. Wheaton College made the argument to the Supreme Court that the idea that they would have to send a letter, or excuse me, fill out a form for this religious exemption to the HHS was also an offense to their religious sensibilities, because by filling out the form, it then alerted the government, which would then alert the insurance agent and would then require the insurance agent to offer contraceptive care separate from, as a rider, separate from the insurance that the, in this instance, college was offering. The insurance companies will eat the cost of this because ultimately it saves them money. But the idea that filling out the form then became an offense to their religiousness in an extraordinary, literally, I mean, it's, I think they call it an extraordinary emergency ruling. They ruled that this was, in fact, an offense to their religious sensibilities. And it took just about 5 days for them, the Supreme Court, the five white male Catholic justices, to say that the reason why they found the Hobby Lobby thing in the manner they did was because that there was already a government exemption, so the state did not show that it was necessary to compel Hobby Lobby to offer this health insurance. And so that's where we are in terms of Hobby Lobby. In the meantime, there is a court case, and it really depends on who you read here. And I haven't dug into the case too much. It's a case, Halbig versus Burwell, or Halbig versus Sebelius. Sebelius, of course, was the former HHS secretary. Now it's Burwell. So you can find it listed as both. It is a challenge to the Affordable Care Act's subsidies. It is based upon the notion that the way the law, the Affordable Care Act, was drafted is that federal subsidies are offered to people living between 133% and 400% of the poverty line. You receive federal subsidies on your health insurance. So this is what basically makes the Affordable Care Act work to the extent that it does. As the law was drafted, it says subsidies are available only to those enrolled in insurance plan through exchanges established by the state. There was a sense that some states, that few states, would not be able to set up an exchange and that the feds would set up the exchange on their behalf. The plaintiffs argue, essentially, that because there are 34 states that had the feds do set up their exchange, and the plaintiffs in this case, the Halbig plaintiffs, are individuals and small businesses in six states that didn't establish state exchanges. They said without the tax credits that are offered by the federal government, they could have claimed exemption from the individual mandate penalty because they would be deemed unable to pay for the coverage. In other words, if you cannot afford, even with subsidies, to pay, you are qualified for an exemption. These plaintiffs are arguing they would have qualified for an exemption but for the subsidies. And the subsidies were illegally offered them because the law says the exchanges, the subsidies are available to exchanges that are established by the state, not by the federal government. Now, the wording of the law does not say not by the federal government. If you read someone like Jonathan Turley, who is convinced that the Obama administration has gone rogue in changing laws, and in some instances, maybe he's right. I don't know. It sounds like this is going to destroy the Affordable Care Act. If you read someone else, or look at a quote from Simon Lazarus, who is from the Liberal Constitution Accountability Center, he argues, in order to believe this argument, you have to think that Democrats in Congress said to themselves, we really need to make them set up these exchanges. And I know how we'll do it. We'll do it by saying if they don't, we'll give them the power to vaporize the act. In other words, when you look at the intent of Congress, it was probably just an error in the way that it was drafted, because it was definitely foreseen not that 34 states wouldn't set up an exchange, but some wouldn't set up an exchange, and that the subsidies would still be provided. Two courts have already thrown out this case, or I should say have ruled on this case that, yes, this is what Congress had intended, and there's no reason to essentially gut the individual mandate for these 34 states. Right now, the D.C. Circuit Court is looking at it. There are three judges. Two seem hostile to the notion that this should be interpreted based upon what is obvious congressional intent. If they rule that these plaintiffs have a case and basically win, then theoretically the Affordable Care Act will collapse, because without the subsidies in the other 34 state exchanges that are run by the feds, and you should know that if you go to any one of these state exchanges in any given state, it's going to look like, I think, the state exchange, right? I'm not sure about that, but I'm pretty sure it's still branded the state exchange. It's just the back end is done by the feds. The next option for the government is to go to the entire court. In other words, this is a three-judge panel. The government can then appeal and go to the D.C. Circuit Court and ask them to hear it en banc. This is the court case that the Republicans did not want to create, did not want the entire 11 justices to be sitting, if you recall. And they were stopping any nominees. Once the filibuster was nuked, this court was filled. There's no guarantee that judges appointed by Obama will necessarily side with the government in this case. But it is more likely than the three who are sitting on this panel. So keep an eye on this case. Now you understand it. You will hear more about it, particularly if they rule for the plaintiffs. All right, we're going to take a quick break. I don't know. I guess this will be, I don't know. We'll probably,
figure.
I don't know if it'll be a teaser Tuesday or not. But folks, this show relies on your membership. To continue and to exist on a daily basis. I've been doing another show, 3 to 6 p.m., and who knows how sustainable that is? Well, I know who knows, but...
I'll let you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
But this show will continue with your help. So if you have the financial means to become a member today, please do so at majority.fm. I am way behind on emails in Majority Reporters, obviously, almost basically for the past month. Bear with me. I will get to them, I promise. You can also support the show by buying your crap from Amazon through our link. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. You can find this at majoritireportkickback.com. Go to majoritireportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, buy all your Amazon crap through that. We get a kickback. Every little bit helps. JustCoffee.coop. In fact, I was upstate this weekend in Hudson, New York. They sell Just Coffee at a coffee shop that used to be right across the street from my old office when I was doing my radio show up there. And I'm going to try and get the guy to get the Majority Report blend in that office. That would be big. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's great coffee. It's co-op owned. Do it. All right, folks. We will be back in just a moment. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to give the show a call. You can IM me. You can IM me through the app, majorityapp.com. Oh, bad news, Cleveland. The Republican National Committee will be held in your city in 2016.
But good news for the prostitutes in a Cleveland.
We'll be right back.